Current state here on WKAR. In the past, we've reported about cougars in Michigan. Confirmations of cougars in Michigan are up in recent years. The DNR has confirmed 35 such reports in Michigan's Upper Peninsula since 2008. And one ongoing question amid all these sightings has been, does Michigan have a breeding population of cougars in the state, or are these animals that have migrated hundreds of miles, roamed hundreds of miles to Michigan? Well, state officials said a couple of days ago that genetic testing suggests they are migrants from South Dakota or Nebraska or Wyoming, not part of a native breeding population. One naysayer, Patrick Rush of the Michigan Wildlife Conservancy, says the genetic finding does not change his mind that the state indeed does have a native breeding population of mountain lions. The tantalizing question, of course, is will a breeding population take shape somewhere in the state? And when? Fascinating question. It's Current State on WKAR. Welcome back. It's almost cliche now to say the 2016 election's been an event unlike anything America's ever seen. In just 2 weeks, the nation will decide whether Democrat Hillary Clinton or Republican Donald Trump will become the 45th president. Officials across the country and here in mid-Michigan are bracing for potentially historic voter turnout at the polls. City and county clerks are planning for long lines on November 8th. And quietly preparing their security measures. Joining me now to talk about Election Day prep, Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram. Welcome back, Barb.
Thank you so much for having me.
And her counterpart in Lansing, City Clerk Chris Swope. Hi, Chris.
Thank you for having me as well, Mark.
Chris, this election could drive record turnout across the country. What are you anticipating in Lansing?
I do anticipate that we're going to have a very high turnout. I see that reflected already in the absentee ballots that we've issued. We are trending ahead of 2008 and 2012, so we're on track to hit somewhere around 11,000 absentee ballots issued. So far, we've issued 9,300 just from the city of Lansing, and applications are coming in at a pretty steady pace.
How does that compare with 08 and 12?
In 12, we ended up with a total of 10,000, and in 08, we ended up with 10,500. So we're going to be ahead of those both.
Barb, what are you seeing at the county level?
So at the county level, you know, we ordered ballots for the November 8th general election on September 12th. I have had six municipalities in Ingham County order additional ballots. If you just look at the August primary, that time we had in Ingham County 188,712 registered voters. As of last night, we have 203,773 registered voters.
Wow.
So we have a lot of voters in Ingham County, and as such, many of the municipal clerks have ordered additional ballots to accommodate all of those voters.
A lot of newly registered voters.
Absolutely, newly registered voter, which is so exciting to see.
Are you worried about enough printed ballots?
Well, that's why we did a second round of orders of ballots, quite frankly, because we want to make sure we have sufficient ballots. And the county is footing the bill for all of these ballots, so there's no reason for the municipal clerks not to order 100% voter participation, which I have encouraged.
Chris, what goes into forecasting turnout?
Just the general interest across the country, the amount of advertising, how close the race is in Michigan, just a sense of what is happening in the community. We have had a large number of voter registration forms come into the city of Lansing. You know, as Barb was mentioning, we're part of that growth. I think probably a lot of that is East Lansing and other communities, but we've had a huge number of people that are obviously younger that are getting registered to vote and are excited for this election. So that helps drive what we expect.
Before we go any further here, there's a lot of kind of subtopics that we want to touch on while you're both here. But before we go any further, I want to get your response to the ruling by the federal judge. We heard Rick Pluta on NPR just a couple of minutes ago telling the country about it. A federal judge says Michigan cannot enforce a ban on Election Day ballot selfies. How did you view this whole issue, Barb?
Well, I understand the historical significance of taking a picture, proving that you voted for your your boss and keeping your job. I understand that historical significance, but I also understand the desire to take a picture of a historical moment in time. So I think there needs to be a compromise, but we need to focus on the integrity of the election location and of our elections. But I do believe there should be some type of compromise to allow for people to take that selfie with certain parameters.
You're okay with the judge's ruling then?
Well, it just confuses elections that much more in our great state.
It also begs a question about the future. Where are we going with electronic media, with smartphones and everything that they can do that's going to impact what you two have to regulate?
Right. We already have enough mayhem in the precincts on election day.
I imagine.
Having people pausing to take a picture, you know, maybe they're going to want to take a picture of it as it's feeding into the tabulator. Just a simple ruling overturning our state law does not provide enough clarity for us to move forward, and for it to come at this late of a date, I think is really a little bit tragic, and I'm nervous about the impacts that we could have in the precincts on election day.
Are you going so far as to discourage this practice?
I have personally let the municipal clerk know of the ruling, but I believe the Secretary of State is also appealing that ruling. So, of course, we'll be going to the last possible hour with another lawsuit before another election.
And I agree. I am going to discourage it, but, you know, we will abide by whatever happens to be the law at the time of the election. And, you know, if we're not allowed to prohibit it, we will, you know, at least make sure that it's contained to the voter's own ballot and put in whatever security measures we can. But, you know, we've already trained our election workers, and now to have a change in what laws they're enforcing 2 weeks before the election is really kind of crazy.
There are rules and regulations involving polling sites that have been in play for quite some time. They're established by each state. Barb, what are election challengers and poll watchers allowed to do and not do in Michigan? Talk to us about that.
They are not allowed to talk to the voter. They are not allowed to intimidate the voter. Those campaigning are not permitted to be within the 100 feet of the entrance of the polling location. They will get one warning before law enforcement is called.
Chris, how do you see that in Lansing?
I think we are going to have some people that have been encouraged by a candidate. I think Lansing is where they're going to focus in this area if they're doing that. So I'm pretty nervous about it. I've been in communication with our police department just to make sure that they're going to be available to us on election day should we need them. They've been very cooperative. You know, I don't want them hanging out at the polling places. I just want to make sure that if we need them, they're there and available.
Go a little bit deeper with us, though, here. Who are we talking about?
Well, we've got a presidential candidate, Donald Trump, encouraging people to, after they vote, go watch some other community. And
you know who those people are,
right,
I think that's what he says.
He says, you know who they are. Well, I think what he's saying is watch the bigger cities, and Lansing being the biggest city in the area, this is what I expect is where they're going to show up, is in the city of Lansing. I'm nervous about it. But I can tell you we're putting steps in place to protect our voters, to make sure that our voters have a safe election voting experience, a safe, secure day.
Yeah, and if any voter is intimidated, I encourage them to call their municipal clerk, me, or law enforcement, or all of the above, because I will have no tolerance for voter intimidation in our county.
We're talking about Election Day preparations in the city of Lansing and Ingham County. Barb Byram's the Ingham County clerk. Chris Swope is her counterpart in the city of Lansing. They're expecting high turnout at the polls 2 weeks from today. There isn't just physical security in play. There's also cyber security. What are you each doing to protect the ballot data, Chris? How does that come into your purview?
Well, the machines that count the ballots are segregated from the internet. They're already, that programming is already burned onto the memory packs, and it's completely segregated from the internet already. After it's burned, we test it. So we test each machine, each tabulator, make sure that if we put in ballots and make sure that each candidate gets the number of votes we expect from the test deck we prepare. So it fully tests that. So I'm very confident that the votes will be accurately represented. And then in Michigan, we have the paper backup. So if anything seems crazy, we do have a paper backup. So I think there's adequate security in place for that. And then in terms of the voter list, which has also been one of the concerns, we do have the electronic poll book. But again, that is segregated. We have the Wi-Fi is turned off, can't be turned on election day. So that data, once it's put onto those laptops, is free from tampering.
Barb, do different jurisdictions in the county go about this business differently, or is what Chris just described kind of the standard?
This is the standard in the state. And then to add to what Clerk Swope indicated to the protections of our elections in Michigan, you know, the county clerk will present the unofficial votes on election night or perhaps the morning after, depending upon how late we get those results. But then after that, the Board of Canvassers will meet, and that'll be two Democrats and two Republicans, and they will canvass the entire election and make sure that votes were counted properly and basically audit the election. So with those paper trails and all the checks and balances, I am very certain our elections will be fair, transparent, and accurate.
Could it take longer to arrive at clear results than in previous elections, though? Just given the turnout, given all of that.
Given the turnout, given the fact that we have election equipment that's very old. 2 years ago in the gubernatorial election, we had several of our tabulators went down during the day to the point where we used all our spares and we had to wait for other precincts to finish to use their tabulator to finish up the day. So we could have issues like that. Also, provisional ballots take more time. So if a voter believes they've registered but they don't show up on the list, there's a process they can go through, and that does take additional time as well.
Rumors are, go ahead, Barb.
Yeah, it's all about how old the technology is that we utilize. It's over 12 years old. It's run on Windows XP. So when we talk about tabulators, those are computers that are programmed to read the ballot. And just like it takes a while for you to boot up your computer, imagine if your personal computer were 12 years old. It takes a very long time to process things. And if we have a large voter turnout, that's a lot of numbers, a lot of calculation that has to happen. And it takes a long time to transmit. Mm.
Rumors are swirling about hacking, computer hacking. Have either of you received any guidance on security from either the state or from the federal government?
I wouldn't say I haven't received any guidance, but the list of voters that we have is a state-run database, and it's also decentralized, so the data for City of Lansing residents resides on a state computer, and then nightly that's replicated with the City of Lansing, so it's decentralized, it's in multiple places, and the state has the primary task of making sure that that data is secure.
Oh, what would you say to voters in Ingham County, Barb, who might have doubts this year about the integrity of the process just generally?
Speak to your election official, volunteer on election day. We're still looking for poll workers, and perhaps that'd be a way for people to understand the election process. It's very transparent. It's open. The only time it's not is when the individual voter is sitting with his or her ballot and actually voting the ballot and putting it into the tabulator. Other than that, it is completely transparent, fair, and open.
How many more poll workers would you like to line up in the next 2 weeks?
Well, I know there are a few municipalities that are still looking for more. So usually my larger municipalities are always looking for additional poll workers. There are training opportunities still. Those poll workers must be trained and certified as well.
How is that done in Lansing, Chris? How do you recruit and train volunteers to work at the polls?
We recruit by any method we can come up with. We use Facebook, social media, WKR's current state, anything we can. We're always looking for people. And one of the challenges, to be quite honest, we assign them by political party. So if you think about the City of Lansing, it's a very Democratic city, so we're always struggling to make sure that we have a balance of Republicans. So we're particularly looking for some Republican workers. If you're a Republican and want to work on Election Day, and it's technically it's not volunteering because you do get paid to work on Election Day for your for your local clerk.
For your labors, okay.
Mm-hmm.
We want to thank both of our guests. We've been talking about Election Day preparations in Ingham County and the city of Lansing. Both voting jurisdictions could potentially see record voter turnout on November 8th. Barb Byram's the Ingham County clerk. Chris Swope is the clerk for the city of Lansing. Good luck to both of you as you head into the home stretch.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And coming up on Current State, we review a couple of the month's more interesting environmental news developments, among them the U.S. Inspector General's finding that the EPA could have issued an emergency order in Flint months earlier than it did. Did the EPA drop the ball? Well, also, the report from the U.S. Inspector General says it did. We'll review the story with Current State's Great Lakes reporter and commentator Gary Wilson. That's coming up this hour. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. If you listen to NPR's Morning Edition, you've been hearing voices of voters across America in their Divided States series. The project brings views from across the country from those who've decided to vote for Democratic hopeful Hillary Clinton or Republican nominee Donald Trump. Participants discuss the issues in the election and how their candidates have responded. Here at Current State, we've been listening with great interest, and we recently struck upon the idea of producing our own version of the Divided States Project. We're partnering with MSU College of Communication Arts and Sciences Journalism School students to collect some of these stories. Today, J-School student Camille Douglas brings us voters from different presidential camps, starting with 18-year-old MSU student Christopher Michael.
I support Donald Trump because he is a great businessman and he would be a more powerful leader. For me, it's mainly gun control because I don't want people taking away my Second Amendment rights. And also, I have a huge problem with gay marriage because it's against the Bible. Hillary would not be the better president because it would just be another 4 years of Obama, and she doesn't have the leadership skills or the right. She's not just the right fit for the job.
So how do you respond to criticisms that are made towards Donald Trump?
They're only focused on the negative aspects of him, and, you know, they don't focus on any of the good things he's done.
Will you have a problem answering to Commander-in-Chief Hillary Clinton if that's how the votes turn out?
Yes, I would, because I don't think Hillary would lead this country in the right direction. Currently, the country hasn't been doing that well, and it's time we need a change to make America great again.
If Donald Trump is elected, what are your hopes for him as a president?
I want him to follow through on the things he says. I mean, I want him to build the wall, and I want him to place that temporary ban on Muslims coming into this country because our security is our number one priority.
So when Donald Trump says that this is a rigged election, do you believe that?
100%.
After speaking with Michael, it's no question that he sees Donald Trump as the best candidate to lead this country. So when the time to vote comes around on November 8th, Michael will cast his first ever vote for Mr. Trump. 62-year-old Beverly Talega is a retired special education teacher. Talega, a Democrat, is an avid Hillary Clinton supporter.
Because I think she's hardworking, I think she's trustworthy, and she is for women to choose their own path in life.
I caught up with her in her home in Rochester Hills to discuss more about her selection for president.
And in this election, what are some of the topics that are most important to you?
A woman's right to choose, the economy, family values, and health care. I think that she is for Obamacare, and she wants to make it better than it already is. I think she knows a lot because she was Secretary of State. I think she knows a lot about foreign issues, especially the Middle East. And I think she's for family values. I think she's very much for the woman's right to choose their path. I think she's been professional, but I think the campaigns on both sides have been a piece of garbage. Lots of mudslinging, lots of name-calling. Down and dirty, and I think it's wrong, wrong, wrong.
Have you ever seen an election like this before?
No.
And how does it make you feel that it's come to this point?
Sick.
Talega already voted absentee. She said that she never doubted that Hillary Clinton was best fit for presidency.
Now, hold That was MSU journalism student Camille Douglas with two Michigan voters, Beverly Talega, who supports Hillary Clinton, and Christopher Michael, who is voting for Donald Trump. It's one of WKAR's Divided State stories, which is also part of the WKAR MSU School of Journalism project, My First Election. Coming up on Current State, we'll hear a tale from storyteller Anna Holguin, spun at our most recent pop-up stories event where the theme was turning over a new leaf. That's coming up on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We come your way three times every weekday, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM and every day at noon on AM 870. Our program's always at WKAR.org. This is Detroit Tigers country, but lots of baseball fans to our west root for the teams from Chicago. For them, having the Cubs advance to the World Series for the first time in 71 years is especially exciting. One of those diehard Cubs fans works here at WKAR. Scott Pohl spoke with our colleague Tim Zico about his lifetime of Cubby love. He was there when Chicago earned the right to play Cleveland starting tonight for all the marbles, wasn't he, Scott?
He sure was, Mark, just like he was there for Game 6 13 years ago when a fan named Steve Bartman interfered with a foul ball, a play that was followed by a Florida Marlins rally and heartbreak for Cubs fans everywhere. Zico's love for baseball extends to serving as an official scorekeeper for the Lansing Lugnuts. We talked about his devotion to Chicago's North Siders.
Living across from the broadcast stations in Chicago, those were the strongest signals that we got, just 60 miles across the lake. So I grew up watching the Cubs games because they played day baseball. And when I would get home from school, you could watch almost all of the games, especially with the time difference, because we were in the Eastern time zone. Chicago's in the Central time zone, so, you know, early afternoon, mid-afternoon games beginning in Chicago, you know, we're an hour farther along in our day here in Michigan, so I get to see the whole game.
I've spent my whole life in Jackson County and Ingham County, and it's only the Tigers around here. How prevalent is it to be a Cubs fan in the southwestern part of Michigan?
In southwest Michigan, very common.
You see a lot of that even today?
Yes, absolutely. My wife and I drove in for the game on Saturday this past weekend, and we stopped at a rest stop somewhere in near Pawpaw, and we had our Cubs gear on, and people were hooting and hollering, and we stopped at a fruit market just outside of St. Joe to get some cider and things to take with us to Chicago, and had our Cubs gear on, and people were hooting and hollering, and go Cubs, go Cubs. And so it is a very Cubs-centric area.
So the last World Series championship for the Cubs was 1908.
Correct.
Their two most recent appearances in the World Series were both losses in 1935 and 1945 to our Detroit Tigers.
Yep.
The closest they've come in the intervening 71 years was the Steve Bartman year. What year was that?
That was 2003, and it was game number 6 of the National League Championship Series.
And you were there.
I was there, and as was my wife, and as were my two children.
Again in the air, down a left field line, a long reaching into the stands and couldn't get it, and he's livid with a fan.
Did you have a vantage point to see the Bartman play?
We did. We were sitting in, I believe, the second row of the upper deck between home plate and third base. So we had a very clear view of what was going on. And as a Cubs fan, I would like that story just to die, because it really had, quite honestly, very little to do with the actual outcome of the game. And unfortunately, I think Mr. Bartman has been had a lot of bile thrown his way over the years, unjustly, because he was one of several fans reaching for the ball, and he would have done, frankly, what any fan would have done in the similar situation. You have a foul ball coming your way.
You try to catch it.
And you're looking up at the ball coming at you. You're not really aware of what else is going on around you other than you may get hit in the head with a ball, so you're going to reach up and try and catch it. So that's all he was trying to do.
We're talking with WKAR television executive producer and diehard Cubs fan, lifelong Cubs fan, Tim Zico. So moving past the Bartman season, 2016 rolls around, the Cubs in the preseason. A lot of people are predicting the World Series, including, as I recall, Sports Illustrated. They did not suffer the Sports Illustrated curse, went through the season with the most victories in Major League Baseball. The playoffs roll around, National League Championship Series arrives, and here's Tim Zico at another Game 6, right?
When I took my wife and my family back in 2003, I promised my wife that we would see history, thinking it would be history of the Cubs advancing to the World Series. She has not let me forget that over 13 years, and she's as big a Cub fan, probably even more so than I am. And so when the opportunity presented itself to purchase tickets for playoff games this year, I said, all right, we're going to do it. And I had the choice of what game to get. And I said, I'm going for Game 6 because it's time to right a wrong. And my wife kind of came up with the hashtag fix Game 6. Mm. So that's what she had been talking about ever since I said, well, we're getting the tickets and we're going. So it's just she and I went. My kids, unfortunately, were not able to join us. I would have loved to have had them there. But so it was just the two of us. But yes, we were there on Saturday, Game 6.
Left side.
Tell me about the atmosphere around and inside Wrigley Field before, during, and after Game 6.
It was amazing. And I know that's a word that gets thrown around a lot, but it was electric. It was hopeful. It was confident. There was a quiet confidence and almost sereneness among Cubs fans, which was completely alien to me. It was 180 degrees from the vibe and feeling of Game 6 in 2003. And I remember sitting in the 2003 game, I was sitting next to a former groundskeeper, actually, and we chatted back and forth a bit, but we both agreed we would not discuss the game as it went on. We would, as the outs began to get closer and closer to the World Series, we would show each other hand signs, 10, 9, 8. We got down to 5 and didn't get any lower than that before disaster set in. And for the game on Saturday, I actually had a gentleman sitting behind me that about halfway through the game said, oh, only 14 more outs to go. And I stood up and I turned around and I asked him, please don't do that. And he thought for a second and said, I get it. You won't hear it again. And he didn't.
Smart. So after the game, what's it like there?
It was interesting because we couldn't leave the ballpark for about an hour. Obviously, everyone wanted to stay for the championship trophy presentations and the MVP awards and all the comments and things. But there were so many people outside the ballpark, it was impossible to leave the ballpark because the streets were full. The police in Chicago closed Clark and Addison about 2 hours before game time. We were up on a rooftop patio overlooking the front entrance, and we saw all of the mounted horse police coming down the street with their baby blue helmets, the cops, not the horses, and closed the streets off as far as you can see in either direction, and people were just pouring in. So there was no traffic, but there was foot traffic, and it was packed. There were, my estimate, at least 10,000 people outside the ballpark. There were 42,000 and change inside the ballpark. And ultimately, when the final outs were made, the sound level in that stadium was nothing like I've ever heard in my life.
Tim Zico is a lifelong Cubs fan, and he's one of my colleagues here at WKAR, an executive producer with WKAR Television. Go Cubs, Tim.
Thanks, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Cubs are gonna win. They got the power, they got the speed.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We would like to thank everyone who made a gift and entered into our prize giveaway for our during our 2016 radio fall fundraising campaign. Thank you, one and all. Our final prize is a golf gift package courtesy of Leading Edge Golf. Congratulations to our winner, and it's my pleasure to announce that winner right now, Sharon Reasoner of Lansing. Sharon, congratulations. A member of our staff will be contacting you soon with more information about your golf gift package from Leading Edge Golf. All the information you need, you will have very, very soon. Thanks to everyone for your support during our fall fundraising campaign. More than 600 of you called or clicked to support radio that's important to you with almost $92,000 in financial contributions. Additionally, 10 restaurants and over 50 volunteers supported the campaign. Thanks, one and all. At the end of every month, Kern State revisits environmental developments that have made the news. In October, we learned about the EPA's investigation into the Flint water crisis. In this interim report, the U.S. Inspector General said EPA, quote, had authority and sufficient information to issue an emergency order protecting Flint residents from lead-contaminated water as early as June 2015. The EPA did not intervene until January of 2016. Great Lakes journalist and current state contributor Gary Wilson joins me now from Chicago to break this down. Welcome back, Gary.
Hey, Mark. Good morning.
Help us break this down. First of all, why this interim report?
Well, the interim report, in technical terms, the purpose of the interim report was to issue what is known in EPA parlance as, and I'm quoting here, a management alert. And that is to tell the leadership, especially in the EPA's office, the Great Lakes office in Chicago, that it didn't act with the necessary immediacy or recognize the seriousness of the issue in Flint. Further, to alert the management that they needed to take immediate action to properly prioritize issues like Flint. Now, practically speaking, it was a public and what the New York Times called a, and I'm quoting again here, a pointed rebuke of the EPA's handling of the Flint water crisis. So two messages there.
What were EPA officials doing in this seven-month period?
Well, EPA took the track of, and this has all been discussed and documented elsewhere many times, but EPA took the track of trying to work with Michigan's DEQ while they sought a legal opinion about their authority. That was a process that lasted from the spring of 2015 until November 2015. And then Regional Administrator Susan Hedman told the Detroit News in January of 2016 that the roles were clear, that this was a state responsibility. Now, the Inspector General's report clearly rebuts that position. And I'd add that Hedman resigned later in January of 2016.
What was the impact of the delay on Flint citizens? How much better could they have been served by an earlier EPA intervention?
Well, in this case, Mark, 7 months, a seven-month delay is significant, and I believe the impact was significant. More people were likely exposed to lead for longer periods of time. Flint residents were denied resources and services for 7 months that, you know, could have helped prevent and mitigate the suffering they were experiencing. And here's an example. In January of 2016, when the EPA did use its authority, EPA staff descended on Flint. And it's interesting to look at the EPA's Twitter feed at that point. In a 60-day period, I counted 70-plus tweets with pictures of EPA staffers in homes testing for lead, helping with filters, answering questions. You know, these are all things that could and should have been done 7 months earlier. And I'd add that EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy was on site adding the gravitas of her cabinet-level position to the situation. So there was a lot lost in that 7 months.
How did the EPA respond to the IG report?
Well, they issued a statement saying that they had already taken action based on what the Inspector General put in the report about serious issues like Flint. And there was an aspect of the statement that was slightly defiant. The EPA said that it intervened in Flint as soon as it knew Michigan was failing. And that, according to their position, that would be January of 2016. Now, that runs counter to the spirit and letter, the letter of the Inspector General report. And I'd add here, Mark, it's important to note that the Justice Department, the Federal Justice Department, is still conducting a criminal investigation of this issue. So I suspect people are being careful what they say.
Great Lakes journalist and current state contributor Gary Wilson joins me here for our monthly Great Lakes Month in Review. How does this impact the discussion of responsibility, culpability? For example, does it lessen the responsibility of the Snyder administration or the DEQ, for example, for the Flint crisis?
No, it absolves Michigan of nothing, Mark. This report only dealt with the EPA's lack of action and its failure to use its authority in the crisis. Governor Snyder still has responsibility and accountability for the DEQ and his own personal actions. And Attorney General Bill Schuette is responsible on the legal front, and he's been very aggressive at taking legal action. So Michigan's sins remained Michigan's sins.
You contacted, though, Governor Snyder's office and that of U.S. Representative Dan Kildee. Flint is in Mr. Kildee's district, of course. What was their reaction?
Well, Anna Heaton from the governor's office repeated the often used statement that Flint was the result of a failure at all levels of government. That's their standard statement. She did go on to say that the governor was pleased that other agencies, in this case the U.S. EPA, were looking at process improvements similar to what Michigan is doing. And Heaton also noted that there are other cities. That's important because other cities besides Flint could be vulnerable to the same types of problems.
Let's move.
Representative Kildee, real quick, said it was he was frustrated that the EPA compounded Michigan's failure by not moving more aggressively.
Let's move on to a really interesting development here. The headline reads, "Toxic blob headed for Cleveland." This sounds like a 50s sci-fi movie, but the blob is actually a mass of toxic sediment in Lake Erie, apparently a remnant of 1970s-era pollution. How is this toxic mass exactly threatening Cleveland?
You're right, Mark. A 1950s sci-fi movie. It's actually toxic sediment, as you said. And the problem now, all these years later, is that it's moving, and there's potential that it could be moving closer to the water intake cribs, just a few miles off of Cleveland's shore. So it's a threat. Nobody knows for sure exactly what's going to happen, but you know, there are failures from the 70s keep on giving.
Do officials have a plan to deal with it?
Not really. That's what's being debated now. It could be capped, or the fallback is if it reaches the intake cribs, it's to treat the water. So neither of those options are optimal.
But, you know, Lake Erie was recently designated by U.S. and Canadian officials as the only Great Lake in, quote, poor and deteriorating condition. This can't help the lake's reputation, I imagine.
No, Mark, as I said, the environmental sins of the 70s keep on giving related to Lake Erie. Between the toxic algae and the headlines about a toxic blob on the move, you can imagine how that appears outside the region. And I think it's timely to note that no amount of World Series karma can improve Lake Erie's poor quality or the perception of it.
Well, that's a logical bridge into my next question. As a Chicago guy, I've got to ask you how big of a Cubs fan you are and how it feels there in the city for the Cubs to be in the World Series.
Well, I'm going to surprise you, Mark. I have a lot of respect for this particular Chicago Cubs team. It's been a delight to watch, but my roots are in Detroit, the Tigers, and they're not in it, so I've got to stay with the American League, so I'm rooting for the Indians.
We want to thank Gary Wilson. Once a month, Gary checks in with us. He's our Great Lakes journalist and commentator and current state contributor here. It's been our Great Lakes Month in Review. Gary, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Earlier this month on our environmental segment, we learned about the recent discovery of an invasive species, the New Zealand mud snail, in Michigan's Au Sable River. First, we heard from a member of the Anglers of the Au Sable, who feels the Michigan Department of Natural Resources was slow to respond to inspect a fish hatchery near two spots where the snails were discovered, upstream and downstream. Then we heard from DNR Director Keith Cray, who responded to those assertions and offered his perspective. Both interviews can be found at WKAR.org. A few listeners feel both interviews still left too much suspicion unfairly hanging over the operators of the grayling hatchery. Some said the hatchery ought to be considered a victim of the New Zealand mud snail, not a propagator or a vector. Laura Campbell of the Michigan Farm Bureau is one of them.
A land-based farm, if they get invaded by an invasive species, normally the state will come in and provide them assistance and all kinds of technical help and sometimes even funding to help them get rid of that species. We think that aquaculture, that is people who farm for fish, should be afforded the same courtesy, especially when it's found that they are not the cause of that invasive species entering that area. They are a victim of this species and need to be assisted, not being given the blame.
Current State aims to offer diverse viewpoints on issues. Never hesitate to contact us at currentstate@wkar.org. That's currentstate@wkar.org. Or call me, Mark Bayshore, anytime, 517-884-4776. Speaking of the World Series, a St. Joseph, Michigan newspaper reports that a St. Joe man has surfaced who attended the 1945 World Series that featured the Chicago Cubs and the Detroit Tigers. The Tigers won the series, of course, that year. And according to the paper's editor, Dave Brown, the man produced the ticket to prove it. Mr. Brown says the paper will cover the story in tomorrow's edition. The man was 12 years old at the time. Being from St. Joe, though, it's not known whether he was a Tiger fan or a Cubs fan. We'll have to check that out. Our last pop-up stories of the year was in September at Reach Studio Arts Center. Our theme was Turning Over a New Leaf. With Halloween around the corner, we thought we'd share storyteller Anna Holguin's story. She described a scary tale she was told during childhood. And a word of warning, it is a somewhat disturbing tale. She shares how she came to look at it very differently as an adult.
When I was a little girl growing up in New Mexico, I would always read this story over and over. My grandma would tell me, both grandmas would tell me this story. Adults would tell the story. Everybody tells the story of La Llorona, and she's a wailing woman in white who you scare all the little kids by saying, don't go out too late and don't hang out by the water, otherwise La Llorona will get you. And she has fingers made of ice and she will snatch you up thinking that you are her children and that's what you'll get. Like, this is how we scare people into doing the right thing in the Southwest. So her story is this legend that she was a single mom, and she fell in love with a guy, a bad guy, as some women do fall in love with those. And she just gave all of her heart to him, but he wanted nothing to do with her children. So Beyonce, crazy in love as she was, she figured out a way to solve her problem, and she grabbed both of her kids, took them to the river, and drowned them both by her own hand. Went back to the man and said, no problem, no children, I'm here, I love you, this is how much I love you. And he said, you are crazy, you're terrible, you're nuts, get away from me, you're a monster, look at what you did. And not only is she heartbroken to lose this love of her life, but then it dawns on her the reality that she had murdered her babies. And so she just walks back and forth near any space of water, looking for her children, crying, wailing with this painful howl. And this is the woman who's going to snatch you up if you stay out on a night like tonight that's dark and wet and gloomy. So I thought of turning over a new leaf. I thought of all of the wailing more than the fresh, minty, sweet. I'm going to start over today. I did not think that way. I thought of La Llorona. When I moved to Michigan in 2003 to go to grad school and study stories and their magic and why we tell them, I came thinking I'm going to leave these crazy people of my family and I'm going to go somewhere and do something instead of being stuck and never moving, instead of being held in by those stories of don't try anything or you might die. Something bad will get you if you go too far away. And I was like, bye, I'm leaving. Let her come and get me. So I ran off to here. But what I found was many nights like tonight, rainy and gray. And the perspective of seeing my old life from far away. And that, oh, Michigan doesn't have Weather Channel 7-day forecast of smiley sunshine every single day. And there's no mountains, and the trees and the sky make you feel like you're being crunched down, where at home the sky was big and expansive and felt like you might fly out into outer space and be swallowed up by these beautiful colors in a very freeing way. And all of these things I didn't know I had made themselves very prominent, and I missed them. And I spent a good 6 months wailing in my bed, crying every night, 2-3 in the morning, just tears, not knowing what I was going to do here. Same thing happened when I got divorced. Laying in bed, crying, driving my car past the house I used to live in, past the apartment that he used to live in, past his favorite restaurant, or the park where we would take our dogs, and wailing and crying and howling, and these guttural howls that I would look at the person in the car next to me, and they were terrified and they thought I was crazy. But crying in the car was this weird, freeing thing, and maybe the only place where I was contained and alone. And so it was this thing I would do. But I guess I just wanted to remind you and remind myself that being a wailing woman isn't always to be monstrous, but it means that you're doing something and that you're shaping your story and that you are putting your hands on your own legend and creating something. And turning over a new leaf isn't always minty and fresh and beautiful. It's planting your tears and watching how they'll grow.
That's an excerpt from our most recent pop-up stories. Anna Holguin telling the story there. The theme was turning over a new leaf. By the way, one news note, a Southeast Michigan community has voted to bar Syrian refugees from settling there until what they call security issues are addressed. In what's widely regarded as a controversial move, the Waterford Township Board voted Monday to stop participating in a federal resettlement program for Syrian refugees. Board members say they want some safety and financial issues resolved before continuing, but the entire resolution may not mean anything. It may not be anything more than a message, as states cannot legally bar refugees. A bill has been introduced in Congress that would allow local communities to opt out, but for now the federal government has jurisdiction over refugee placement. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, in Meridian Township, where CATA's proposed bus rapid transit plan has encountered resistance, Voters can choose between candidates for treasurer who disagree on the BRT. We'll ask both candidates why they support or oppose. Plus, for Neighbors in Action tomorrow, we'll catch up with Lansing's Northwest Initiative, the nonprofit that works to strengthen and sustain healthy communities in Lansing's Grand Neighborhoods, the city area bounded by the Grand River on the north, east, and south. And this weekend, the Grand Rapids Choir of Men and Boys is welcoming Dr. Martin Neary, one of the world's most influential living choral conductors. The educator spent a decade leading the music at Westminster Abbey, including directing the music during the funeral of Princess Diana. Current State's Jamie Paisley talks with Dr. Neary about his gig in Grand Rapids. That and lots more tomorrow on Current State. We again want to thank everyone who donated to our WKAR fall fundraising campaign. And again, we want to congratulate Sharon Reasoner of Lansing, who won our final prize. That was a golf gift package courtesy of Leading Edge Golf. Congratulations, Sharon. Thank you, Leading Edge Golf. And we want to thank everybody who contributed. More than 600 of you called or clicked to support WKAR with almost $92,000 in financial contributions. Thanks again, one and all. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, Drew Hill, and a special thanks today to Isaac Constance. Don't forget the Current State podcast, informative, insightful, indispensable. Anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. We'll see you tomorrow on Current State.